Hello, welcome back to the Matt Pfeiffer Experience. I am your host, Matthew Pfeiffer, and today we have on a very special guest. We have on Linda Henkel, and she is with the law offices of Linda Henkel out in New Jersey. And you guys know how we operate here. I don't bring people on that I wouldn't hire myself, that I wouldn't advocate, or I wouldn't refer to a friend or a family member myself. And so her and I connected on Instagram. I know a lot of you on Instagram, so as this show progresses, you can go down into the show notes if you want to connect with her. All of her information will be there. If you want to hire her, if you want to reach out to her for a consultation, if you're in the New Jersey area, you're about to go through a divorce, or if you need some sort of modification or some sort of adoption or anything that is related to family law. With all that being said, I'm not going to monopolize all the time. I'm going to turn it over to Linda. Linda, welcome to the Matt Pfeiffer Experience. Thank you so much for giving us your time and letting us tap into your experience. Tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got started.
Okay, well, I got started quite by accident. Later in my career, or later in my life, I got recruited into law school, Rutgers Law, and I was marrying and family, you know, the whole deal. So it was quite a little bit of a struggle getting through law school, but it was actually an amazing experience as well. When I graduated law school, there was no jobs whatsoever. I came out right in the middle of the worst period of time possible for lawyers in New Jersey. And so I started my own firm immediately, which is something you're not supposed to do. But that was almost 15 years ago, and I've had a pretty good time doing it ever since. So there's no regrets here.
Well, awesome. So you started out right away, and you I always tell people that or almost every attorney I've ever interviewed always says the same thing, that they backed into it. You know, that so you backed into, you got recruited in terms of a lawyer, but a lot of people, they either back into family law or get backed into going to law school, that sort of thing. And so you've been doing this for about 15 years. What would you say is the most challenging piece of being a divorce attorney?
I think probably the most challenging thing was just human beings. Sometimes hiring the right employees or having challenges with court staff when they get confused or lost, particularly after the pandemic, things got a little rough there for a while. Some clients, certainly I've had many amazing clients, but now and then you come across somebody who has some unrealistic expectations and is a little difficult to deal with. So the human factor.
What would you say is the most common, because I hear that all the time, is having unrealistic expectations. And when I did provide therapy services, it was something I dealt with, or I would help attorneys out with. If an attorney referred someone over to me, oftentimes that was kind of the issue. What are some of the most common misconceptions or most common unreasonable expectations that people have?
So the hardest conversation that I ever have in a consult is when I have the high earner spouse, male and female, who has the spouse on the other side who has not worked for quite a while, for perhaps no reason whatsoever. Maybe the children are already adults, maybe there are no children, but this person has decided they don't want to work. And I had to have the conversation with them that just because that decision was made by another party, maybe even if you didn't agree with it, it's happened and it's been a while, and now you're going to be paying alimony. So that's the worst conversation to have, because I have to explain to people that their good actions don't always yield the good consequences in court that you would hope for or expect if you were thinking about it in a moral or on the street kind of way, as opposed to the court thinking process.
One of the things when it comes to alimony, when it comes to child support, and I think that a topic that is coming up pretty frequently is that of prenuptial agreements. So when it comes to prenups, like, is that something that could alleviate that topic that you just shared, in terms of a high income earner worried about paying out alimony, or even a post-nuptial agreement where maybe they were both working and both high earners, and then they had kids and the arrangements changed. So maybe there's a post-nuptial that needs to go into place. Is that something that could alleviate a situation like that?
So every state has their own rules about prenups and postnups, but I will tell you, generally speaking, neither a prenup nor a postnup is going to in any way affect children's rights or support. Children have a right to support on their own. That's considered something that you can't contractually waive for a child on behalf of the child. However, when it comes to alimony, absolutely it can be beneficial. It can absolutely be beneficial if you do it right with the prenuptial. Postnuptials are very easy to destroy. There's a level of distrust that courts often have toward postnuptials, that there's no proper contract setting. But with prenuptial agreements, it absolutely, if done properly, with the disclosure of assets and liabilities, with the proper both parties having been represented, proper notice. You can't do it a week before the wedding because it's probably not going to hold up when the time comes. But if you do all the right things and you disclose everything, then absolutely a prenup can help you with the alimony issue.
Yeah. I hear a lot of people that give pushback, in particular, the person who may, it's typically from my perspective, you might feel very differently, but anytime I've advocated for prenups, it's typically the person who makes less that doesn't want the prenup. And I always tell people, and again, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I've heard of prenups that weren't necessarily written in a way where that person ends up with nothing at the end. It's typically written, or the times I've seen them written, were written where there was like a tier where, you know, after 1 year, they had X amount of settlement. After 5 years, this settlement. Is there protection for the lower income earner within a prenup, or is it just kind of all or nothing?
So first off, I think the objections come from both sides sometimes, both the higher earner or the lower earner, because of societal expectations. Sometimes people feel they're non-romantic. They don't want to sign this thing, even if it protects them, because I'm not going to admit that there's a possibility that this relationship could end.
Right.
And it's too painful to even imagine.
Right.
So I'm not going to sign this thing. Or a pride issue, something of that nature. Yes, I'm making a lot, but I'm not going to try to force my wife or husband to feel that they're not entitled to something. Yeah. That being said, absolutely, you can write a prenup any way you want. You can have a step up. You can create certain clauses in which certain property is excluded, and give exceptions where they might become included. So, for example, a premarital house, as long as it remains in the name of the original owner, it's excluded in the prenup. But you can place in the prenup that if it's decided that the name of the other party is going to go on the deed as well, that becomes marital property. So there's a lot of ways that you can structure your prenup so that time goes by, there's more possibility to collect, there's step ups, there's anything you can do, pretty much anything.
Yeah.
You just have to negotiate it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I agree with you that a lot of people, you know, don't even want to admit that the relationship could potentially end. But one of the things I try to bring to people's attention is that all relationships end either in death or divorce.
Right.
So there's not really any other choice. And you need to have your, you know, affairs in order, regardless of which way that it goes. If you're setting up trusts, or if you have a prenuptial agreement. And so it's better, you know, in my opinion, it's just better to be safe than sorry.
Right. Right. And the one thing that so I have a lot of seniors getting married, getting prenuptial agreements, and some of them have the idea when they come in thinking that they're going to be able to use a prenup to exclude Medicaid from getting money from them. That's not going to work. The government will always supersede your prenuptial agreement. So there's a lot of things that people have to be wary of when making these plans, but it's still a great idea to at least have the conversations with an attorney.
That is a twist that I have never heard, you know, and it actually inspires another question. Are you seeing people that are getting married now later on in life, or really you see them at the end of their relationships, or are they getting divorced later on now?
I would say both. There's a lot of second marriages or third marriages that are older, and then people choosing to divorce sometimes after a second marriage that's maybe 10 years in the making, but they had a previous marriage that was very long.
Yeah.
Or it's a very long marriage, 25, 30 years, and they just have to enough because they're realizing they're running out.
Yeah. Well, you know, one of the things that we talk a lot about divorce, but, you know, I don't think that we talk enough about a second divorce or a second marriage, third divorce, third marriage. Do you see any differences in a divorce after their first divorce? Are the two people either more well-prepared? Are they just as not prepared as someone who's going through their first divorce? Are there any differences between someone who's been there, done that, versus the ones who haven't?
A lot of times people who are going through their second divorce are a little bit more jaded. They might be even more angry because this is the second time having them, but they also maybe have a little bit more of a realistic expectation of how things are going to go than that first divorce. But that every individual is different. So sometimes people are surprising in how they handle a second one, either positively or negatively.
Yeah. It's not always necessarily a negative experience, I imagine, but I can also see where someone is extremely jaded, especially if they've just repeated the same cycle as what they did previous.
Right. And whether there's children or not makes a huge difference in how much anger there is a lot of the time.
Uh-huh. When it comes to children, that always, and especially in the divorce, that hits such a you know, raw spot for a lot of people. Because people have this feeling that if you have full custody of the kids, that you've quote unquote won the divorce, right? And everyone always wants to win the divorce. And going back to something else that you said was that, you know, people have to harbor such feelings, you know, towards the divorce. And so everyone, a lot of people, I should say, not everyone, wants to win. And it always kind of brings up this conversation of like, what's fair, what's just, and, you know, family law is very, very different from any other law out there, criminal law or immigration law. Those sorts of things, oftentimes there can be a little bit more of a black and white, you know, yes or no. You know, this is what the law says, so you're guilty of XYZ or you're not guilty or whatever the case is. But with family law, it's very, very different. And oftentimes both people feel like it was unjust or unfair, or both people might feel like it's fair, or, you know, just the kind of combination. Can you talk to us a little bit about why that is, or, you know, what is it about family court that makes it very unique in that sense?
Sure. So first off, I always say family court is the wild, wild west of the law. Sometimes the rules aren't followed as strictly. People are endlessly upset about the fact that discovery isn't on time, as though it's the first case in the entire history of the world where discovery has not been on time. Well, it happens in probably 85% of family law cases.
Yeah.
So, and courts are not going to hold people to the fire on those issues the way that they would in a criminal court or civil court. So people are surprised by that. But overall, I think two things that I regularly say to clients is, number one, nobody wins in family court, as you pointed out. Absolutely nobody wins, not even the lawyers. Nobody wins. At the end of the day, if it's a successful divorce, everybody's a little unhappy, but able to live with the result.
Yeah.
And then secondly, I will always say that there is no judge that can issue an order to make your ex not a jerk.
Yeah.
It just can't be done.
Uh-huh.
They can say, hey, don't be a jerk, but it's not something they can enforce.
Uh-huh.
If the person is going to be a problem, they're going to be a problem. And there's not a whole lot that you can do about it until it wanders into the realm of really extreme behavior.
Yeah.
So abuse, neglect, something of that nature, obviously a totally different subject. But if they don't like to put the kid to bed at 7:30 and you do, court does not care.
Yeah.
If they're 15 minutes late for parenting time every week, court does not care. The things that you care about, the court does not care.
Right.
They want to see, are the kids okay? they don't care if they're, you know, doing the living their best life. They care, are they okay? They're okay. And the money has been divided in a way in accordance with the statutes. They're done. Mm. You know, wipe the hands, and that's the end of it for the people in the Black Rose. So I think that people very often feel that they're going to go into court and they're going to tell their story. And the judge is going to be so overwhelmed with pity and pain for the experience that they've had that they're going to completely change the way that the law works to suit them. And it's just, it's not going to happen. It's not. The reality is that judges hear the same stories.
Yeah.
And even though it's painful and important and serious, and I take it seriously.
Yeah.
I can't make the law take it as seriously as you do.
One of the things that you meant, you alluded to this, and I kind of sum this up. I tell people whenever we do divorce coaching for people who are talking to their attorneys and kind of organizing their thoughts for not wasting time, not wasting their attorney's time, things like that. I tell them, don't major in minor things, things that it's not going to be relevant in court, or things that really, for you, then it might be important. And even me as a therapist, I might feel it's important, but in the eyes of court, you're just really just going to be spinning your wheels. Mm-hmm. Can you talk to us about like the difference, and, you know, is there kind of a way for someone that might be listening to be able to tell the difference between like, oh yeah, this is something I need to take to my attorney versus, you know what, this really aggravates me, but I just need to let this one go.
Yeah. So one example, in New Jersey, we're a no-fault state. So mm-hmm. most divorces, almost all divorces, should be pled in a no-fault manner, but there still are the old causes of action on the books, like adultery, extreme cruelty, those sorts of things. And sometimes people will want to talk to me about how important it is for them to adultery or something of that nature because it's happened. But unfortunately or fortunately, the courts in New Jersey do not care at all. They're going to make you prove it, but it will not yield a better result for you in any way. The only way that an adulterous relationship impacts your divorce is if there's cohabitation and there's an alimony issue, or if the person that your spouse is involved with has a criminal record or something, and you have children.
Yeah.
Other than that, the court could care less about anybody's activities, whatsoever. So I think a lot of times that you can start having a conversation because you don't know what you don't know. But if a good lawyer will say to you, you know what, let me redirect you to the things that we really need to focus on in order to get you the best result here. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to say, you know, I'm sorry that happened to you. The court is not going to focus on that, but tell me about the assets, and tell me about the debts, and tell me about your children's routine. Those sorts of things are the things that are really going to.
Do you oftentimes, when you have that conversation with people, do you oftentimes get pushback?
Not often. A lot of times, honestly, I think a lot of people are relieved that all of that emotional stuff isn't going to get played out in a courtroom. Mm-hmm. There are some people who have an axe to grind and they really want that. Mm-hmm. Those are probably not my clients because I don't. There are lawyers out there who their stock and trade is in building the drama and making people experience that through court. They're going to give their big speech. The judge is not going to care, but their client feels vindicated because that's been said.
Right.
I feel that you're better served with me focusing on the things that actually are going to yield a result for you.
One of the things I say all the time is that even if you do get that moment in court, it's not really actually going to be good enough. It actually starts this black hole of revenge and, you know, spitefulness that you think you're going to enjoy that. And then when the judge doesn't care, sometimes your ex doesn't even care. You find out that you find yourself wanting more or doing more to try to create that revenge narrative. And it literally just doesn't stop. Until you actually stop yourself, until you actually start, you want some work on yourself.
Mm-hmm. They're never going to say they're sorry. And if they do, it's never going to be enough.
Mm.
And ultimately, if you have children with this person, they're the ones that are suffering, not that other person.
One of the things that, if we talk a lot about these type of dynamics here, but, and not doing that to the other person, what do you recommend to your clients whenever the other person is being spiteful towards one of your clients?
So I think that is very difficult to manage because you want to protect this person, it's your mm-hmm. client, you want to protect them. But it probably isn't a surprise to them because that behavior probably was existing during the marriage, which is why they're getting divorced.
Right.
If there's any kind of physical threat or any real harm happening, and certainly when in violence laws, they can protect themselves. Well, if it's just that the person is playing a mean, I am always going to say, do you want the psychological win or the real win? Mm-hmm. Let them run their mouth and let's focus on doing what we need to do to get you in the best possible spot, to end this marriage, to get your children where they need to be, and to have everything be right in your life. And then just let them run over there and run their mouth.
Yeah. I mean, that's really difficult for a lot of people to do, I imagine. Just allow, it's something I've advocated for over the years. Just, they're allowed, I tell them that they're allowed to say whatever they want. They're allowed to feel, they're allowed to have their own story. And they're allowed to have their own opinion about what happened and why the marriage is dissolving. And you're welcome to have your story too. But it's very difficult for people to allow for that to happen. Is there any, in New Jersey, is there any rule or statute or anything about that? If someone were to take their story and, talk about it on social media, I'm going to give an example. I don't know if you've heard of Risa Tisa. But she's become very popular here on TikTok over the last couple of weeks. And I think, at the time of this recording, she's at like close to 3 million, followers just after, a couple of weeks of her sharing her story online. Situations like that, is there anything that someone can do to, if they're afraid that their ex is going to do something like this, or is it okay on the other end if someone does share their story? Because you always hear stuff about, libel and slander and defamation. Does that apply in family court?
So first of all, I think, unless I'm mistaken, Risa Tisa does not identify him. His actual name and information.
I don't think she does.
Yeah.
I know I think she calls him Legion. I don't think that's his real name.
Right. Right. So I think that is a protection. You can tell any story you want.
Right.
As long as you're not, here's their address and their name and here's where they work, that sort of information. I think if you're putting that out there and you're putting someone at risk in that way, doxing them or something like that, That could fall under harassment, and there could be harassment charges. Defamation is incredibly difficult to prove because you have to prove that whatever was said is true.
Yeah.
And that's not always easy to do. In most cases, defamation is a hard road. But if they're saying, hey, go get this guy, or, my wife is horrible, here's where she is right now, that could fall under the harassment statute for sure.
What happens in those situations in a divorce proceeding where someone is found guilty or liable of those type of dynamics?
So we have, there's two elements to that. So there's the criminal, and then there's the domestic violence law in New Jersey, which is quasi-criminal. Mm-hmm. And so you can get a restraining order against someone, but they don't have a criminal record for whatever it is, because that's tried in an entire different court. So if there is a restraining order, then it can affect the way that custody plays out. But if the children aren't involved, at least in New Jersey, then you're still going to probably have parenting time. You're still going to have, unless there's been a particularly violent assault or something that shows that you're not capable of having them.
Yeah.
And then the economics are going to play out the exact same way, unless you're proving a cause for damages because of a physical injury as a result of a domestic violence.
Same. Linda, you have been absolutely amazing. You are a wealth of knowledge. And I know everything that you've shared today is going to be, you know, I know people are probably going to be listening to this a lot. Can you share with people where they can find you at, some, you know, your social media handles, you know, if someone wants to work with you, if they want to send your information over to their friend or family member, what's the best way for people to reach you?
Sure. So I am on Instagram, as you know, at Hinkle Law. You can find me on the web, lyndahinkle.com, and all of the other socials are connected to that.
Awesome. And if you are watching this on YouTube, or maybe you're watching this on, or listening to this on Spotify or Apple Podcast, make sure you comment down below a takeaway or something that you may have learned from today's episode that maybe you didn't know before. Also, give Linda some love. Make sure you guys go over to her website if you are looking to book, if you need a consultation. Also, make sure you guys go over to her Instagram, show her some love over there. Like and follow and share to friends or family members or other people who are in the New Jersey area who might need her help and her assistance. With all that being said, thank you very much. My name is Matthew Pfeiffer. This is the Matt Pfeiffer Experience, and I will see you in the next episode. You guys have a good one.